It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the latest research on the first Americans, the first humans to cross over into North America. First, some people will be going dry in January, but high-risk drinking is up overall around the United States. Some of the biggest increases are among older Americans and women. That's according to an annual survey published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Wisconsin has long seen high rates of binge drinking and driving under the influence. A report from 24/7 Wall Street last year placed 12 Wisconsin cities as some of the, quote, drunkest in America. But Wisconsin communities have long tried to encourage more responsible alcohol consumption and treatment for addiction. Laura Heeb facilitates the Brown County Alcohol and Drug Task Force. She's the chief nursing officer and senior vice president at Bellin Memorial Hospital. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, when you see these numbers around the country, what are you seeing, Laura, here in Wisconsin and in your Brown County area?
Yeah. In Wisconsin, we continue to obviously carry the title of one of the areas with the highest binge drinking rates in the nation. I think we're second to North Dakota. So we continue to struggle with that, and that particular problem comes at a cost for Wisconsin of about $6.8 billion a year related to the outcomes of alcohol misuse.
Can you talk about what we mean when we say binge drinking?
Mm-hmm. According to the CDC, we use a definition of binge drinking for women. It's four or more alcoholic drinks in one outing, and for men, it's an average of five or more drinks in one setting.
We've done shows in the past on binge drinking, and I have seen responses sometimes on our social media saying, well, if you define it as that small an amount, of course we all binge drink. I mean, people have a different cultural norm, it seems like, of drinking here in Wisconsin than around the country.
That's true. On average in Wisconsin, the binge drinking number that we tend to be located at is about 9.6 drinks on average is what our individuals will consume. And you hit it on the head when you talk about the culture. When we think of Wisconsin and we think of how we're represented across the nation, many times we are looked at as the state that is very high with our drinking rates and our binge drinking problem. And that's one of the things that our task force is really focused on, is how do we influence our culture around alcohol misuse, and how do we create a culture that leads us more to healthy choices or alternatives to binge drinking.
That national survey we mentioned found the increase in binge drinking around the country being driven by women and by seniors, older people. Let's take each of those in turn. Let's start with women. Are we seeing women binge drinking more here in the state?
You know, we don't have the actual detail driven down to our county levels, but anecdotally, we are seeing women on the rise with their binge drinking rates. And, you know, we've talked about that in our task force, and there's probably multiple factors that play into it, but the fact, you know, that stress plays into it, mental health issues, depression, access to alcohol, those are all things that are playing into what we believe is influencing our women.
And how about seniors?
You know, it's interesting. Our data with the seniors, as we looked at some of the data, it shows that our seniors here in Wisconsin tend to have less social connections as they get older. So they're more socially isolated. And that is one of the influencers that we believe is playing into the use of alcohol, along with, again, high rates of depression or mental health issues. And you put those things together, and there is that opportunity for alcohol to become a larger problem in both those segments.
We're talking to Laura Heeb with Bellin Memorial Hospital. She's also on the Brown County Alcohol and Drug Task Force. She's the facilitator there. Laura, let's talk about solutions you're working on in your area. What kind of efforts are there to bring down binge drinking?
Mm-hmm. Well, our task force is mainly focused in three particular areas. And one is public awareness, you know, just creating the awareness around the problem and the output of what alcohol causes to our community. That's one of the key areas that we're looking at, as well as also focusing in on public policy. You know, what are we doing in our communities related to the number of alcohol outlets? What are we doing related to local ordinances or legislative issues that could impact binge drinking or alcohol misuse? And then the third area that we're really focused on is access to care, making sure that we have what is needed for those who are struggling with alcohol and that we can get them in and get them help. So those three focus areas that we have are very much in alignment with what the Surgeon General just put out in his report also, saying as you work on these issues within your community, you really have to take multiple approaches in order to influence an outcome.
As you talk about these issues in your community, do you get the sense that we in Wisconsin, the public at large, are taking this seriously, or is it more that's just Wisconsin, we drink here?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I think we get, you know, there is a little bit of that thought process, and the culture is really hard to, I think, break into. A lot of people have that mindset. They believe, you know, it is Wisconsin. This is what we do. And you know, many people say, well, that's a big part of our everyday life. And what we want to look at is, are there alternatives to that? And can we create an environment where, you know, you can drink sociably, but you do it in a way that's safe and it's not detrimental to yourself or to others around you? And that's what the team is spending a lot of energy trying to, I think, get our arms around. The other thing is, you know, that the alcohol industry is a business. And one of the things that our task force is doing is trying to collaborate with the Tavern League and those who are in business and serve alcohol to say, again, how can we collaborate together to do it safely and work on the culture within our community?
I want to look at another demographic group. We talked about women and seniors going up when it comes to binge drinking. Apparently, millennials drinking less at this point than other generations. What do we know about younger alcohol consumers?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we're talking about when it comes to the millennials is what their preferences are. And, you know, we're seeing that the millennial group is focused on health and well-being and creating that family type of environment. So, and also being good stewards in their community. And I think we're seeing that have some influence, although, again, within our particular market, I haven't seen as dramatic of a decrease in the millennial group. The one thing we do know is that some of our millennials also are more interested in more of microbrews and some of these specialty types of drinks, which are more expensive, and so they tend to have less of them.
You mentioned the lack of social connection for seniors. You mentioned the connection between with social drinking. Is part of the answer here looking at the way we interact with each other, connect with each other, and making sure that at least some of the time that doesn't include alcohol, or at least not that much alcohol?
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that the task force has been working on is trying to create a positive feedback loop to those folks within our community who are following a lot of the evidence-based practices when it comes to serving alcohol within their events. And, you know, those who actually have chosen to not serve alcohol or who do it sparingly, the task force is sending them some positive feedback saying, hey, thank you for, you know, coming up with alternatives and for creating a safe environment and following a lot of the standards that we recommend if you are going to host and serve alcohol. But one of the things is, you know, trying to create an environment where alcohol is not the main focus, and that the other activities that are at the event are the main focus.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Laura Heeb facilitates the Brown County Alcohol and Drug Task Force. She's the Chief Nursing Officer and Senior Vice President at Bellin Memorial Hospital. Been talking about new national data showing an increase in binge drinking in the United States. We've been finding out how that plays out here in Wisconsin. Right now, new discoveries are shedding light on an ongoing mystery: when humans first came here to North America and who they were. Gemma Tarlak is with us now for a look at the latest evidence and the ongoing story. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Rob.
Well, Gemma, let's start with the questions we're trying to answer here before we get into some of that new evidence. So the questions, as I understand them, when did people arrive in North America? Who were they? How did they get here? Are those some of the key points we're trying to figure out?
Yes, that's exactly it. And what's really exciting is that we're getting more and more evidence from a lot of different streams, from geology, from glaciology, and most recently from paleogenetics.
And now, when I was growing up, to the extent I paid attention, my understanding was there was a time, the climate was different, there was a land bridge across the Bering Strait from, you know, Siberia, you know, that special part on the risk board, Kamchatka to Alaska. And that's when people came over about 10-ish thousand years ago. Not necessarily what happened now, we're thinking, right?
Yeah, well, a little bit of that is right. So walk with me, if you will, back.
Not if there's glaciers. I'm not walking on those.
Well, no, let's go back about 20,000 years to Beringia. And that is the land bridge that is connecting what's today Siberia and Alaska. So they were once connected. There was this massive land bridge called Beringia. And during the last glacial maximum, when a lot of water was tied up in glaciers, this area was exposed. And it was, you know, it was not a bad place to live. It was probably warmer than it's been in Wisconsin most of this winter. And it was, there was game, there was vegetation, there were fish in the sea. So it was an okay place to live and not nearly as extreme in terms of cold as you might think. And we know from previous genetic studies and some archaeological sites that a group of people moved from Siberia into Beringia as early as 36,000 years ago. And they stayed there for thousands of years, and they were loving life as the last glacial maximum, again, made this not a bad place to live. And it's from that population that we believe Native Americans and all the indigenous populations of the Americas, both North and South America, those are their ancestors, the folks living in Beringia. But the questions, like you said, remain, okay, who came over from Beringia? When did it happen? And how did they get here?
Right. And that 10,000-ish year mark that I mentioned, it sounds like that's probably wrong because there were people apparently in the southern South America and Florida by then, long before then.
Yeah. The 10,000-year mark has gone by the wayside a long time ago. You know, we have evidence, there's archaeological evidence of humans in Monteverde, Chile, as early as 14,000 years ago, potentially as early as 18,000 years ago. There is a site, a fascinating site, because it's actually an underwater archaeological site in a Florida river, and it's a mastodon butchering site that is more than 14,000 years old. We have found genomes of ancient Native Americans from Mexico, from Montana, all 12,000 years or older. So we know that definitely the first Americans had crossed over Beringia and were well into the Americas by well before 13,000 years ago, probably much earlier.
So I want to look at some of the various more recent evidence. One we've talked to you about a little bit before, the Kelp Highway. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, the Kelp Highway, it's a great name. I mean, it just gives me a complete mental image. And basically what they're finding, again, from a number of different disciplines, archaeology, biology, paleogenetics, they think that if you were, say, in a boat in Siberia and 16,000 years ago you just started paddling east, well, you could have made it all the way to what is now the western coast of the United States just by following the coast and not really leaving your boat to cross overland, but just following the coast, enjoying the seabirds, the fish, the shellfish, and yes, the kelp, that delicious kelp, you know, sustaining yourself with that and really getting everything you need either from the coastal ecology or from the sea itself. So they think that is actually the most likely route for these Beringian populations to have arrived in the Americas, because the overland route across basically what's now Alaska and much of Western Canada, that was still covered up in ice and really impassable, inhospitable, until fairly recently.
So then that raises the question, if people came via the West Coast, maybe paddling along the way, The next question is, when do they start moving east?
Exactly, and that is the question that a lot of archaeologists, anthropologists, biologists, marine ecologists, that is the question that's obsessing them. Because, you know, the problem is, let's say you and your extended family were coming over in boats, and maybe you came on shore every now and then to build a fire. Well, whatever site where you built that fire, that site's now underwater. So it's really tricky to find archaeological evidence of this kelp highway hypothesis. But that's not stopping them. And in fact, there's a new wave of research underway specifically to look at those underwater archaeological sites and hopefully find evidence of those, you know, brief camps that people might have used while they were crossing over on the kelp highway.
So Gemma, if I'm hearing this right, I'm imagining a group of scuba-trained archaeologists. I mean, I'm joking, kind of, but that's presumably that's what's happening, right? Because they're underwater.
Yes. Well, I mean, there are a few ways to do it. You know, there is technology where it's easier and easier to see underwater, to test, say, substrates underwater, to look at the submerged rocks and actually the seafloor, looking for potential signs of human settlement. But there is a sub-discipline of underwater archaeology, which is fascinating. And, yep, these folks put on their wetsuits and sometimes their cold suits, and they go down underwater, often in very difficult environments, and they find incredible things. That site I mentioned in Florida, the mastodon butchering site, it's actually in really swampy water where there's zero visibility. And I talked to one of the archaeologists who's done the work, and she said, you know, you really can't see in front of your face, and every move stirs up sediment, but yet they were able to find all kinds of tools and bones that showed butchering. So it sounds kind of crazy. It's very difficult, but it is possible.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at the latest science on when and how people came to North America. And Gemma, one of the most recent things I'm reading about now is DNA evidence of someone translated from the local language in Alaska called Sunrise Girl Child. Can you tell us about her?
Yes. A little over 11,000 years ago, she passed away. She was only 6 weeks old, and she was buried with a couple other children who died very early underneath the hearth of a home in what's now Central Alaska. And scientists have been able to reconstruct her entire genome. And this gives us a lot of fascinating new information, but one of the most important things to emerge was that she appears to be part of a population that we did not know existed. And they're calling it the ancient Beringia population. And basically, these were the people who were living in Beringia and then moved into Alaska and died out. They were not direct ancestors of Native Americans. So it's this new population that we don't know a lot about. And I want to be a little bit cautious because I know there were a lot of headlines about this, but this is a single genome. And it's tempting, but it's difficult to draw broad conclusions about entire populations from just one genome. But what I'm excited about, quite frankly, is that scientists are adding more and more of these ancient Native American and First American genomes to research and building a database, and that's super important. And what I love about it is it's coming out of increased collaboration and cooperation between the researchers and the indigenous communities. You know, for a long time, you may remember with Kennewick Man, there were lawsuits. It was very ugly. People in Washington State were fighting over who had the rights to this ancient 8,000-year-old fossil, individual that was found in Washington State. It was very ugly, but I think researchers now are understanding that, you know, these are someone's ancestors, and we need to treat them with respect, and we need to talk to the people who are most likely descended from them and work with them rather than at odds with them. So I think every new genome that is added to the research database is fantastic. I think it's wonderful that people are more and more interested in this area.
What's the next piece of data that you would be hoping for, Gemma, to answer some more of these questions?
Well, you know, speaking with scientists in this field, I've heard murmurs that we will be hearing about a couple new sites in the coming year. There are a few sites, such as Triquet Island, which is on the west coast of Canada, that looks very promising in terms of potentially confirming some of the kelp highway hypothesis and potentially being an archaeological site that goes back far enough to show that people were traveling by boat. And, you know, the next huge discovery is always a shovel away. And I think more and more people are focusing on this area. It's certainly heating up in terms of interest and the number of excavations. And I think we're going to be hearing some really fun stuff in 2018.
And Gemma, I want to revive a bit of an argument you and I have had in the past. You probably know where I'm going. I say it would be cool if we had like a time machine or even just a time camera and we could just get definitive answers. You don't want that. You don't want the easy way. Not that time travel is easy, but...
Well, it's not that it's easy, but, you know, and this is going to sound terribly hokey, but I really think that in the process of discovering scientific truths, we discover something more about ourselves, too, as a species. And if we're just kind of handed all the answers, well, that's terribly boring.
I respect that. I guess I could go along with that. Also, I don't have a choice. We don't have the time machine. Gemma, thanks a lot. It's always a lot of fun to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to chat with you again.
That was Gemma Tarlak. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. We've been talking a little bit about time travel, but mostly about the still unanswered questions of how and when humans first came into North America and some of the latest evidence and discoveries. First, you may not expect prison food to be gourmet dining, but what if it's making inmates sick? In August, a prison worker in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan was reportedly fired after refusing to serve rotten potatoes. Stories of questionable food quality are not hard to find. But new research has revealed that the food and the way it's served may be hazardous to inmates' health. According to a recent study from the CDC, correctional inmates are 6.4 times more likely to suffer from food-related illness than the general population. Joe Fassler is the features editor at the New Food Economy. He's been following this issue. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be in the program.
You write that this is, in effect, a hidden public health crisis. Talk about, before we get into the detailed causes, talk about the scope of this problem.
Sure. Well, the CDC study tracked the rate of foodborne illness over the from 1998 until 2014. So it's a really serious study that spanned a number of years. And they found that foodborne illness in the correctional system led to over 20,000 illnesses in that span. And that might not sound like that many, but it's actually, if you compare it to the general population, it's, as you said, 6.4 times more often. It's also twice as many deaths. There were 5 deaths in that span. And if you compare that rate to the general population, you're twice as likely to die from a food-related foodborne illness if you're incarcerated. So it's actually pretty dramatic, even if the numbers on paper might look small.
And you write about a variety of causes, but it seems like the biggest problem is these are big kitchens, commercial-style kitchens in scope that serve food to a lot of people, but with almost none of the food safety precautions that you'd see in an actual commercial kitchen.
Yeah, that was one of the surprising things that we found. So as you mentioned, you hear these dramatic news stories about rotten food and that kind of thing. But, you know, according to the CDC data, really the biggest issues are food remaining out at room temperature related, and that can be related to bad infrastructure, you know, improper refrigeration, that kind of thing. It can be related to improper food safety conduct in the kitchen. In some cases, it can be related to sort of contraband food, you know, people bringing food back to cells. But in general, this sort of stark public health crisis has really mundane roots. It really is happening in large part, not necessarily because the food that's being served is bad, although there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of that happening, but because the food's staying out for too long, not being kept cool when it's supposed to be kept cool, the way that it would in a commercial kitchen at, say, a restaurant.
Yeah, if I open a restaurant, there would be a health inspector coming by from time to time, fining me if they saw my staff leaving food out for too long or not having the right kind of cleanup facilities or cross-contamination, whatever. I know it may be different from state to state, but what is the state of the art when it comes to inspecting prison cafeterias?
Well, that's one of the issues, is that it is widely variable, and it can vary from state to state and county to county and institution to institution. So while there is an overarching sort of federal rule book that is the sort of basis that institutions use for crafting their food safety policies, it's more permissive than you have in a commercial kitchen, you know, in civilian life. And oftentimes we found that the breakdown of responsibilities is actually not clear. So you're going to talk about privatization later on the program. And we found that sometimes there are major disagreements between the people who run the facility and the private food service contractors who are there just simply to serve meals about who's supposed to do things like purchase cleaning supplies, or who's sort of, you know, on the hook if something goes wrong. There can be a lot of disagreement about that because the rules just aren't clear.
Yeah, staying with that outsourcing part of the story, you write that that's part of the reason for low quality food, apart from the safety issue, and it may lead into the safety issue that if you've got an outside contractor, their incentive is to do things as cheaply as possible so they take home as much of the money as possible.
Yeah, you know, and we talked to Aramark, who's one of the big private food service contractors in the correctional system, and you know, they will say that their meals are sort of scrupulously designed, they serve enough calories and that kind of thing. And I have no reason not to take their word at that. But the thing is that a lot of these, the purchasing itself happens on a much more local level. And there can be a sort of system of perverse incentives where the company gets to keep the money they don't spend on meals because they're paid a flat rate per meal. So that, you know, there are plenty of complaints. You know, you hear it all the time from people who know this world well, that the food is not up to par, and that's one conceivable reason why there may be issues there.
Talking to Joe Fassler from The New Food Economy, he's written about the risk of foodborne illness in prisons. Prisoners, inmates, 6 times more likely than the general population to get a food-related illness. We're talking about some of the causes of that. And Joe, as I understand it, in a lot of these prison kitchens, a lot of the workers there are inmates themselves, and they may not get much or any training in food safety, it sounds like.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. There are some programs in place, again, depending on the institution and depending on the sort of whims of that particular place. But a lot of people are kind of thrown into the kitchen from what we've found. And it's a desirable job, maybe for obvious reasons. So it's not that the work is necessarily bad. It's that the people who are doing it are often very inexperienced, and they don't have good tools at their disposal either.
And that's partly because of safety concerns, right?
Sorry, what aspect? Well, it depends, right? I mean, in some cases, the safety concerns can become an issue because of the way that the prison kitchens are designed. They're often small, but inmates have to be sort of kept a certain amount of space, you know, feet apart, and that makes an already kind of cramped space even harder and more unwieldy to work with, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, but apart from the safety concern, you write that food safety, when these kitchens are built in prisons, food safety is often an afterthought.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as with so many things in American life, the major consideration is price. And so they're often designed as cheaply as possible. They're not the major... they're an afterthought, as you said, and so that is not conducive to getting, you know, good, safe food into people's bodies.
And Joe, you talked to some inmates and I think others who said this is a missed opportunity. We've got these inmates in a work setting. They could be making the food more safely and coming out of prison with a marketable job skill, working in a kitchen. Can you talk about what people would like to see happen?
Absolutely. So it is a missed opportunity. And it's not to say that it doesn't happen at all. Aramark, for instance, a private food service contractor that I mentioned, they do have a program doing just that. But it's not very widespread. In general, you know, from what we gathered, serious food safety, you know, vocational training that leads to a certificate that could be used again in civilian life is really not common. And that's too bad because, you know, it is the inmates that are running these kitchens, and equipping them with better skills, you know, would not only help to sort of reduce this problem, but it really can be a path to a career, you know, upon reentry. And we did find a great program, LA Kitchen in Los Angeles, that is helping to do exactly that. They're working with a sort of range of different types of individuals, but one thing that they are doing is helping the formerly incarcerated get food safety certificates that can actually be used in commercial restaurants and cafeterias. And so it's really the rare win-win. There's no reason not to do it.
As we wrap up, Joe, the CDC numbers are the starting point here. As you were talking to people who work in the prison system, inmates themselves, the food providers, do you get a sense of urgency that people are saying, oh, yeah, this is a problem. We got to do something about this?
Well, not really. I mean, it depends on who you talk to, right? There are plenty of advocates, you know, who work on human rights within prisons, and the sense of urgency is definitely there. The sense of urgency is definitely there among inmates themselves. But one of the striking things about the study is that it was actually done by the CDC a first time, which was between 1974 to 1991. And they found almost the exact same thing, except the rates are slightly higher now. So this has actually been an issue not just, you know, for the past 20 years, but for the past 40 years. And it's continued unabated. If anything, it's gotten worse. And I think part of that is because there's a lack of accountability, because there's a lack of interest from the public. And one of the things that I found that was most striking in the response to the piece, a lot of people are horrified to see this, and it's the first they've ever thought about it. But there also was a fair amount in the comments on the internet of people saying, well, who cares? You know, if you've committed crimes, why should I care if your food is good? And so I think, unfortunately, that attitude is out there, and it's probably part of the problem is our correctional system is seen as punitive, and the food itself is punitive. So hopefully by building awareness about this issue, the human beings who are incarcerated will have more of a voice in getting food that doesn't make them sick.
Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Joe Fassler is the features editor at New Food Economy. He joined us today to talk about the high risk of foodborne illness for prison inmates. Now, over the holidays, you might have sent a care package to someone you were thinking about but couldn't be with. Maybe you put in some favorite foods, reminders of jokes you share, a special shirt. Now imagine if instead you could only send this person items you found in one catalog you were given, produced and owned by one private company. In many prisons and jails across the country, this is what loved ones of inmates experience. Taylor Eldridge is a fellow at the Marshall Project and recently wrote a piece called The Big Business of Prisoner Care Packages. Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Taylor, for someone who hasn't been in this position, talk about what people have to go through to send that care package to a loved one who's incarcerated.
Sure. So if a family, you know, happens to be lucky enough to have internet access at home and a credit card, they can go online and, you know, browse a catalog of pre-selected items. But if you don't have a credit card, if it's not easy for you to access the internet, then it becomes a lot more difficult to even, you know, access the catalog, let alone actually place an order. So it's, you know, families are directed to these websites of these private companies, and then, you know, it's like a shopping on Amazon, but a lot more expensive.
And it's hard to just, you know, go out to a store and buy something and send it. What kind of screening would a something that somebody just bought at a store and sent in go through it at most prisons?
So at most prisons, you know, each any package that comes in has to be checked for any type of contraband. So that involves, you know, opening up the box and, like, some places use x-rays, some places just, you know, do a visual inspection. And then if anything might raise a red flag or anything like that, then you have to take it a step further and actually open any items that are in a package. So these private companies, you know, offer ways to simplify that process for corrections agencies.
Right, because the stuff at these companies would be pre-screened. They know it's going to meet prison approval.
Exactly. They're going to be in pre-approved packages. They're not going to be, you know, no way to make a weapon or any kind of drugs out of it. Everything is sealed. It's very clearly hasn't been tampered with in any way.
And you mentioned the expense. What kind of costs are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so the price of items really depends on where your loved one is. Even within states, you know, something as simple as a pair of boxers could be $2 in one facility. But, you know, in the next county over, they're $7 for the same pair of boxers. And a lot of it is, you know, snacks that you would find at, like, your local 7-Eleven. You would pay, like, $4 for some pork rinds. It's kind of, they're very different prices than what you would find, you know, at your local corner store.
And there are limitations. I know people often would want to send books, and there are charitable projects that provide books to inmates. Is that also covered under this?
So it depends on the agency's policies. So I know, for example, New York just recently made the switch to private package companies and included in their list of things that they will not accept from anyone except for these private companies is books, and that has a lot of, you know, advocates concerned with regards to, you know, inmates' First Amendment rights and things like that. But it really depends on the corrections agency.
Talking to Taylor Eldridge from the Marshall Project, her piece, The Business of Prison Care Packages, can be found on the Marshall Project website. Taylor, I think people who maybe don't have family members incarcerated might be thinking, well, prison's tough, but you're there for a reason. So what? So what would you say to people about why this is a problem they should be concerned about?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the families that I spoke with, they all acknowledged, you know, we acknowledge that our loved one committed a crime and that, you know, people have to face consequences for their actions. But to have to jump through all these hoops and pay these really expensive prices and not be able to send anything that you have picked out personally or that is special to your loved one, it really harms the family. It's not just another punishment for inmates. It harms innocent people on the outside as well.
Can you talk about the big business side of this? How much money are we talking about in these prison care package companies?
Yeah, so we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. So, for example, Keith Group, which runs Access Secure Pack, is one of the larger private programs in the country. They reported net sales of over $375 million from their contracts for care packages and commissary and tech programs in 2012. So it's a lucrative business for these companies.
And how do they enter into these arrangements with a prison or I guess a state prison system?
Right. So a state prison system will put out a call for proposals to, like, run their commissary or, you know, run their package program. And these companies will often make bids that, you know, describe how the corrections agency won't have to pay anything. The private company will pay to set up all aspects of the, you know, infrastructure they'll need to run these programs. And then they will also offer commission from any revenue. So not only will the state have this private company building all the stuff for them, they'll also get, you know, a chunk of the money that they make off of inmates and their families. So it's often bundled in a contract for other services. So, like, Access Secure Pack would be part of a contract that also includes, you know, the food in the prison kitchen, the phone calls, and things like that.
And Taylor, I got to say, this is a part of the American economy I had no idea existed in the first place. What led you to try to follow this thread?
I was just sitting with my editor one day, and we were just talking about, you know, what is actually in a care package? How do you actually send one to someone? And then I started doing some research, and it became clear that it was a lot more complicated than we had thought at the beginning, and that these, you know, there's this huge network of companies and all this money flowing around. So we just followed that.
And as you say, this is in states around the country. The rules might be different from place to place. Are there states or localities where they've regulated this or try to put caps on prices or things like that?
Yeah, so the contracts are negotiated between the local corrections agencies and the companies. So if you're, you know, a bigger county, you have a little bit more sway in these negotiations. So, for example, in California, L.A. County negotiated for the prices to stay within 2% of the average price of that good at the local convenience stores within 12 miles of the central jail. Like, it's a very detailed price limitation. And other places, there's no price regulation included in the contracts.
And finally, Taylor, you talked, as you said, to some family members about this. Can you talk about the human link that people see, the family on the outside sees in being able to send something to their loved one who's locked up?
Yeah, so for a lot of families, it you know, being able to pick something that they know their loved one will enjoy and send that to them while they're, you know, incarcerated, it means the world to these families, especially if they're not able to, you know, make the trip down and visit in person or anything like that. Just being able to have that connection of selecting something that they know will mean a lot to their loved one is critical.
And there's no indication that anybody's looking to change the system as it exists right now, is there?
Not quite. It's pretty lucrative for the corrections agencies and the businesses. So.
All right, we'll leave it there. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Taylor Eldridge. She's an investigative fellow at the Marshall Project. She joins to talk about her latest piece. You can find it at the Marshall Project website. It's called The Big Business of Prison Care Packages. Now, I know when we've talked about prison issues in Wisconsin in the past, we have heard from you. I'm curious, do you have a story? Is this something you've done, sent a care package to a loved one who is incarcerated? If you have, please tell us about it. You can email us ideas@WPR.org, or you can send a letter, care of Central Time. That's Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 537-066. Definitely. If this is a story, if this has been a part of your life, tell us what that care package meant to you if you were an inmate yourself or the family member sending it. Again, email ideas@WPR.org or just send a quick tweet. Central Time at Central Time WPR. The Consumer Electronics Show is this week in Las Vegas. This is the big event for people who are fans of high technology gadgets, and it's the place where many of the products of the future make their first appearance on the public stage. And sometimes these new products are hits, they're part of our lives. Sometimes what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. We were looking at some of the hot new items. A lot of them are just faster or better versions of old stuff, new laptops, higher resolution TVs, that kind of thing. Some of them, though, they're things that maybe we didn't know we needed. One line of products takes smart technology and puts it in the bathroom. So, for example, there's a smart shower system that lets us tell Alexa or whichever one of those home network talking things we use to turn on the shower for us. Because I don't, maybe I'm not forward-thinking enough. I don't really think of it as that big a chore. I don't see that as a huge time saver, though it does also let you set the exact temperature, which I could see being kind of handy. And then there's a smart mirror that can be personalized to give us exactly the illumination that makes us look good, which is great because you're going to think you look awesome and then you head into the fluorescent light at work and you look like an extra from The Walking Dead. Oh, and this one I liked, luggage that follows you around at the airport. It has a camera that, I don't know, I could see that running into trouble, but it would be handy to keep your hands free going, you know, through the security, for example. High-tech topics here on Central Time.